The men's prayer breakfast is going to be February 13th. That'll be, I believe, this Saturday already. And it'll be at 8:30. And so, men, if you're able to be there, we would love to be able to talk to you and then pray together and just see God do some great things to that. And so if you can be there at 8:30, that'll give us enough time to get together in fellowship and still make it to the soul winning as well. And then, of course, the Sweetheart Banquet is February 26th. And it's going to be starting at 6 o'clock. And Pastor Dylan has agreed to come preach to us. And so I'm excited about that. It's $10 per couple. That includes the child care. That includes the meal. And I know you'll have a good time. I hope you'll make plans to be there. And, of course, there's the shower and soul winning and the rest of it. I'll not read every one of them this morning. I want to get right into the message. But I hope that you'll, as I said earlier, take time to read through that. Psalm 24, let's read the first two verses. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein. Verse 2 says, For he hath founded it upon the seas, and established it upon the floods. You know, as I have prayed about this month, stewardship month, you say, why not just a stewardship Sunday so we can get it over with? Or do we really need to talk about stewardship for an entire month? And I'll just tell you, I'm going to have a hard time fitting it all in just a month. God has so much to say about what He's given to us. And so this morning, I want to get a biblical perspective on finances. And if we do that, I believe that we will understand the principle of stewardship. You know, there's a few things in life that you never forget. Things like, I hope, the day that you got saved. Maybe for many of you, the day that you walked down the aisle, or perhaps the day you saw your bride walking down the aisle. Did you lose me here? All right. Maybe it was the birth of a child. Some of you can remember the first place that you and your spouse ever lived together. Maybe it was the first house you ever bought. But these things are always really in our mind, they're categorized as firsts. But I know for most of you, if you're old enough, will remember the very first car you ever owned. For those of you that aren't old enough, you're dreaming about the very first car you'll ever own. My first car was a 1984 Camaro Z28. It was awesome. My sister sold it to me for a dollar when I was only 18 years old. Now, the outside of the car was a rust bucket. It was terrible. The paint was peeling. It looked like somebody had forgotten about it and left it. And really, she had left it sit for several years outside. But before she let it sit, you have to understand that she had done some work to it, or had some work done to it. She had some engine work. The pistons were bored out, so it sounded and drove a little bit more like a race car. She actually, I don't know how she did this, but on a Camaro, she had it lowered. And so as you drove, it felt like you were in a sports car. And yes, that car got me into a lot of trouble. I remember, though, the first month that I had it, I was in the Navy and I was stationed at Great Lakes, Illinois. Now, I had grown up driving mostly in Tucson, Arizona, and I really wasn't used to the snow, but I can remember we got a terrible snow one time, the lake effect there, and we got about a foot or a foot and a half worth of snow. And I wanted to take it out. There wasn't very many people out, and I kind of wanted to get used to driving in the snow. And so I went out there, and there was nobody around, and all the snow had fallen, and I pulled out my keys. Now, some of you will remember, this is how old I am, there used to be two keys to get into a vehicle. One was for the door, and the other was for the ignition. So I got my door key, and I put it in, and the door locks were frozen. It wouldn't turn. So I tried the other one on the passenger side, and that wouldn't turn either. But I remembered that there is a trunk on that Z28 where you had to pull down the license plate, and there was a lock in there. And I put my key in there, and it wouldn't work, but I didn't remember my sister doing this, but there was a little one of those little magnet key holders. Have you ever seen one of those? And it was put right there, and I said, well, I wonder if that would work any better. Maybe this back lock has a third key that I didn't know about. So I opened it up, and sure enough, there was another key in there, and I slid it in, and I turned it, and the trunk on that thing opened right up. Opened right up. It was perfect. So I had to crawl through the back seat and crawl into the front seat in order to be able to sit down. So I put my key ignition in there, and it wouldn't turn, and I didn't really know what was going on. So I opened up the car door in order to shut the back trunk, and so I could see what was going on. And as soon as I did, the alarm started going off. Now I want you to know something about the car that I owned. It did not have an alarm. The locks were not frozen, and there was no special third key for the trunk. I had a major problem. I had an ownership problem. That car wasn't mine. I had just broke into somebody else's car. It was the same model. It was the same year. But with a foot and a half of snow on it, I could not tell that it did not belong to me. My problem was that I was trying to use something for my own glory that belonged to somebody else. Hey, let me tell you something. As soon as I found out it belonged to somebody else, I treated that car much differently. I jumped out of it. I locked it all back up, and I put that little key right back. But there's one thing I couldn't do. I couldn't stop that alarm from going off. And so the footsteps walking up to the car were about 2.5 or 3 feet apart. And the footsteps going away from the car were about 5.5 or 6 feet apart. Too often our problem as Christians is that we have an ownership problem. Now, I'm not talking about whom we as people, as Christians, belong to. There's no argument. We would all agree that when we get saved, we belong to Christ. And there's little argument that too often we pull ourselves off the altar of sacrifice, and I understand that. But this morning, I want to look at the area of stewardship. And we as Christians need to see that materialism is robbing us of spiritual power. And everything we own, and everything good that we have, and every resource at our disposal belongs to God. And we must honor Him then with the possessions He has left us to manage. I want you to see the synonymous parallelism. That's a big fancy word for saying that verse 1 is really repeating itself. And you can break it up in what they call strophes. But it says the earth is the first part. He's making a declaration. The earth is what? The earth belongs to whom? The earth is the Lord's. He says, and the fullness thereof. So he expounds on that thought. The psalmist is saying, listen, the earth belongs to God, and everything that fills up the earth belongs to God. You know, in the second part of that first verse, he's really just re-emphasizing that same thought. It's not a new thought. It's not the earth and the world, and we're looking for a way to what's the world? Is that the world system? No, he's just making another, or saying the same thing, just a little bit in a different way. And so you could say the world, and if you wanted to italicize this, it's not in the text, but it would say, is the Lord's. And they that dwell therein. So what is the thought? The thought is pushed just a little bit further. Not only is it everything that is in the world, but that includes then people. Everything animate or inanimate. Most commentators connect this psalm with David's bringing the Ark of the Covenant back into Jerusalem, there in 2 Samuel chapter 6. But I'll tell you, we're not going to go study that, but what I do want to use this as kind of a springboard to understand that if we're going to have the right perspective on finances, on stewardship, then we must understand the principle of ownership. And it's simply this: God owns it all. God owns it all. First thing I want you to see is the possession of possessions. The possession of possessions. You can word it this way: do you own your stuff, or does your stuff own you? The two lines of verse 1, as I said, are parallel, both of them stating that the earth and everything, including the beings on it, belong to God. One commentator said you could reword it this way: To Jehovah belong the earth and its fullness, the world and all those that dwell in it. As I said, that includes everything that's been ever created. So we have to come to the conclusion, or perhaps the realization, that God's the one that owns everything, and we are but managers. We're going to finish that thought later on. But very clearly, this verse teaches us that God owns everything. It all belongs to God. You know, that's a rude awakening if you have been accumulating things for some time. It's hard to hear that everything you have labored for, everything you've worked toward, everything you've saved for, everything you've spent a lifetime accumulating or collecting actually belongs to someone else. But it's true. Unfortunately, we forget that. And before long, we start thinking that we own everything. But in actuality, when that begins, when that process starts, the truth of the matter is those things begin owning us. It begins slowly, but we start thinking about all the things that we need. And then those needs drift away, and we start thinking about our wants. And pretty soon, we blur the line between our needs and our wants. That's how the last several generations have landed in such dire debt. There's been a great confusion between our needs and our wants. We think that because something or we see somebody else have something, automatically we need it. Or we see that our parents had those things that we'd like to have. And no longer is it a want, but suddenly it's a need. We forget that it's taken them 25 or 30 years to get to where they are financially speaking. We'll spend one Sunday night on getting out of debt and staying out of debt. And so we'll not dwell on that this morning here. We also believe that since we worked for it, since we earned it, we are entitled to the fruit of our labor. And if we're going to get the proper perspective on finances, wealth, and stewardship, we're going to have to accept that God is the owner of it all, and He also has even given us the strength to go out and earn the living that we have. Deuteronomy 8:18 says, "But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is He that giveth thee power to get wealth, that He may establish His covenant, which He sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. It is He that giveth thee power to get wealth." You know what that means? That means everything you have in your closet belongs to God. When you open up your refrigerator, for however short a time it might be in there, but it's still God's. I want you to understand that. When you go out to the garage and you look and see the car or cars or the carport that you have, and you look under there, you understand that those belong to God. The tools that you have belongs to God. Listen, we can't section it off and say, yes, it all belongs to God except for. Everything. By the way, if verse 1 is correct, which it is, it's not just the material things in our lives. That means your children belong to God. That means your spouse belongs to God. Now, I'm not talking about in a relational sense. I'm talking about in an ownership sense. Do you understand that? That means that if your child gets saved and they come to you and they say, listen, God's called me to the other side of the world. Don't you dare tell them that's not a good idea. They belong to God. And that's going to be the best place for them. And the safest place for them, by the way. And so everything belongs to God. Hey, it's not just stated here in Psalm 24. It's stated over and over and over again. We are reminded constantly that God is the owner of everything. Psalm 89:11 says, "The heavens are thine, the earth also is thine. As for the world and the fullness thereof, thou hast founded them." Exodus 9:29 says, "And Moses said unto him, as soon as I am gone out of the city, I will spread abroad my hands unto the Lord, and the thunder shall cease, neither shall there be any more hail." Why? That thou mayest know how that the earth is the Lord's. Exodus 19:5 goes on to say, "Now therefore, if you obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall hear a peculiar treasure unto me. Then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for the earth is mine." Psalm 50:12, "If I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine in the fullness thereof." Deuteronomy 10:14, "Behold, the heaven and the heavens of heavens is the Lord's thy God, the earth also, with all that is therein." Job 41:11, "Who hath prevented me that I should repay him? Whatsoever is under the whole heaven is mine." Are you starting to get the idea that God owns it all? Psalm 50 verse 10 says, "For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon a thousand hills." Haggai 2:8 says, "The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts." Even in the New Testament, we are reminded, a quote from Psalm 24 and 1 Corinthians 10:26, "For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." It all belongs to God. But you know, we have a bad attitude about that sometimes. We're not pleased. We're not thankful for what we do have. We have the attitude, "Yeah, well, God owns the cattle on a thousand hills, but I'm only getting a hamburger at a time." You know, we think, "Oh, all the silver and the gold is God's, but all I get is a filling at a time." Listen, that's not the right attitude. How can God make this claim? How can God say, "I own it all"? I'll tell you why. Because He created it all. Because He's the creator, He is the owner. The principle of stewardship starts with the idea or the principle of ownership. And God is the owner. All right, so we see the possession of possessions. But I want to see the pursuit of possessions. I have two thoughts under this. The first one I would say is wicked materialism. What's your goal? What's your goal in this life? Is it to get more? Do you have the get more mentality? Our entire economic system is based on getting more. One writer said, "Everybody buy. It doesn't matter what you buy, just buy. It doesn't matter if you don't have money, just buy." Our entire civilization, one author said, now rests on the assumption that no matter what else happens, we will all continue to buy lots and lots of things. Buy, 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 buy. And then buy a little more. Don't create or produce or discover. Just buy. Never save, never invest, never cut back. Just buy. But what you don't need with money, you don't have. Buy like you breathe, only more frequently. I cut out a little bit of an extended quote to help you to understand where we are as a nation. You see, in 1955, Fortune magazine interviewed a large number of 25-year-olds who were starting to build their careers. And the study portrayed the group as dedicated to family and community service. They held that same study again in 1980. With a new crop of 25-year-olds, but this time, the results were strikingly different. Over the span of 25 years, materialism had made remarkable inroads. And writer Gwen Kincaid summarized the attitude of those interviews. Here's what she said. They believe that business offers the fastest means of gratifying their frankly materialistic requirements. Deferred success, which was the traditional basis of the work ethic, hold little appeal. Now remember, this is going back to 1985. They expect to enjoy immediately a relatively high level of material comfort. And one man, a management trainee at a life insurance company, echoed the consensus. He said, "I like to spend money. I don't feel like giving up any luxuries. I grew up with lots of land, private schools, horses, dogs, a car at 16. And listen, if you looked at that from another generation, the previous generation, you probably think that group in 1980 or 85 were a materialistic bunch. I think you'd be right. She went on to say, it seemed that almost they flaunt their ambitions. They say, why bother with goals if you don't shoot for the top? They have worries about marketability, and that those worries have turned this group into this constant skill watcher who towed up the chances of promotion on one side, and they look at their salaries against the going rate, they never do anything that won't enhance their records because they're always looking for that upward mobility. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to do those things to try to get ahead in your job and do well, but what's your motivation? It ought to be to please the Lord. Let me finish reading this last quote. These are unabashed materialists, she says, who crave the latest labor-saving and electronic hardware. This is back in the 80s, along with frequent entertainment and travel. She said, scarcely any 25-year-olds have children at present. Most of those doubt they will ever be parents because they can't spare the time. Another man, an accounting officer at Chicago North Trust Company, said, I love kids, but I don't want any. I'm too selfish to give what's necessary to raise them properly. And eventually, I'd resent taking me away from my interests, just as I'd be upset that I wasn't devoting enough attention to them. Some already view owning a home, that means having two incomes to cover the mortgage, as more desirable than having children. Later in their lives, the choice may be between having children and an even higher standard of living, or perhaps greater job mobility. And one woman in that group stated, with our lifestyles, we just can't afford good child care and all the things we want. Out of that group, few devoted their time to public service or volunteer work or expressed concerns about social programs. And they said this about organized religion, which was favored by the 1955 group as a social and family adhesive. But to this group, it appeared too prescriptive or irrelevant. And the majority called themselves agnostic or privately spiritual. Now ask yourself this question. How much further down the road of materialism have we gone since 1980? We are just the same, if not worse. I think they called the 80s the me generation. But the truth of the matter is, when we look at our lifestyle, we realize that our choices, our life choices, reflect our true belief rather than what we just say we believe. Do you understand? What you live out screams to the world what you believe more than what you say you believe. And so our pursuit of material things to gain more, to indulge our selfishness, has not gotten any better over the last 35 years. And so America has plunged even deeper into trying to find happiness with stuff. I want you to remind you what the Lord said in Luke chapter 12, verse 15. He said, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things in which he possesses. There is no happiness in things. Now listen, this is not a message condemning capitalism, all right? Capitalism is by far the best economic system in the world. It rewards those that work and labor and produce and have worth in the marketplace. But what I am condemning is the endless desire for more and more and more and more. God created us to love people and to use things, not to love things and use people. Now, you may be thinking, Pastor, you sure have taken a long time to explain the problem. I'd have to say you're right. This is almost still the introduction. But you know, we're so careful. We're so careful to think that everyone else is materialistic. Listen, I'll just tell you, the Lord put me over a barrel as I've been studying this. What is it that brings us satisfaction? What is it that we're searching for to find happiness? Are we looking to add more stuff to fill up our lives? Listen, let me tell you something. It's not everyone else. It's us. Be careful to look at your own heart this morning. Be honest with yourself. Be honest with God. Because materialism is sneaky. And if we're not careful, our goal to get more will crush our spiritual life. You know what was the materialism that led the church of Laodicea, not into doctrinal heresy, not into some kind of dysfunction, but simple, bland Christianity. Revelation 3:15 through 17 says, I would thou were cold or hot. Verse 16 goes on to say, so then because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. But listen, what was the cause of that lukewarmness? It tells us in verse 17, because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Hey, listen, we have all of our needs met. We don't have to go to the Lord daily and ask for our food. We go to the cupboard instead. Don't be blinded by that goal to get more. Because if you feel dissatisfied with your current whatever, I'm going to let you fill in the blank. Every time they come out with the next generation of whatever it might be, whether it's your phone or your computer, or listen, could be your golf clubs or a hair care product or some kind of cleaning solution. They always have a new one right around the corner. Maybe it's a cooking appliance, whatever it is. But I'll tell you something. Our goal, if our goal is to get more, it is in lockstep then with being greedy. We must be careful of our goals and we must be careful of greed. 1 Timothy 6:10 says, for the love of money is the root of all evil. Listen, it didn't say money is evil. It says our conspiring to get it, our finagling, everything we're doing, when our focus, when our love, when our attention and our affection is on money, that's the root of evil. Listen, it's not just the idea that stuff brings happiness, but it teaches that our heart often wants more. Do you know what the rest of that verse says? It's not just the love of money that is the root of all evil. He says, but which some coveted after, they have erred from the faith. It's caused people to derail their spiritual lives. But also, it has pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Let me tell you, money and the love of money does not bring happiness. But that love will bring great sorrow because you will never be happy and you will never be content as long as you want more and more and more. Is it wrong to work hard and accept a raise? I don't think that's wrong at all. But if your whole motivation in life is to get more so you can accumulate more, so you can show the world how much you have, that's a major problem. That's a major problem. Even the world is kind of getting an idea on this. I read one report that said by the age of 20, the average television viewer has seen 1 million commercials by the age of 20. That was back in 2000. In 2000, more Americans declared bankruptcy than graduated from college. Back in 2000, about 90% of divorce cases were really arguments about money played a prominent role in that divorce. Do you realize every commercial you've ever seen has one intent, and that is to make you dissatisfied with what you have? This is a message you see in print, you hear it over the airwaves, you read it online, you see it on television, and millions of times in your life. But yet study after study after study prove that more things do not bring more happiness with it. Americans today, compared to 55 years ago, own twice as many cars, they eat out twice as much per person, but we don't seem to be any happier because of it, said one report. Rather than rising levels of well-being, we've seen mounting credit card debt and increasing numbers of self-storage facilities to house the things we compulsively buy. Listen, let us not fall victim to wicked materialism, but rather let us use wise management. Wise management. If God owns everything, which He does, and our sinful heart is constantly striving for more stuff, looking for happiness, and yet falling and failing miserably short, then what is the answer? Well, the answer is this, is to realize that we are simply managers of those things that God has placed in our grasp, and we must ensure that we use those things then for His glory. That means when we look at our savings account, we'll see His money instead of ours. It'll change the way that we spend. It'll change the way that we save. It'll change the way that we share or give. 1 Corinthians 4:2 tells us this, "Moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found what? Faithful." Be faithful. It's not an option for us to handle our resources in a way that is pleasing to God. The Bible says it is required. Hey, by the way, let me ask you young people something. How do you treat the things that God has given to you to be a steward of? Is it when you come in to your room, everything you're wearing just gets thrown on the floor, or whatever you're using gets just tossed over to the side? Your parents say, hey, that costs money. They may tell you things like, listen, if it breaks, you're going to have to buy another one. And that might get your attention a little bit. But the honest truth is, you ought to treat things with respect because they're not yours. They say, oh, yes, they are mine. No, you're just a steward. And God is allowing you to use those things. But you know, that message and that principle is not just for young people. That's for every one of us. When I was in high school, I went to school with a guy. He had an Audi. His family was very well off, and that was a fun little car to drive. But you know, he never changed the oil in the 4 years that we were in high school together. And I don't know how it lasted that long, but about a week after we graduated, the engine burned up in it. Why? He was a terrible steward. But I'll tell you, he had the attitude, I don't care, I'll just get another one. But I'm going to tell you, that's not how God operates. Do you realize that your management abilities are being evaluated by God? Luke 16:10-13, I'm going to read the entire passage, but I'm going to emphasize just one of the verses. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. Verse 11 says this, if therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you, to your trust, the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. Listen, I wish we had time to really fully unpack that entire verse. We're not going to take time to do that this morning, but I want you to get this principle from it. Understand that our faithfulness in managing God's finances, as I said, that you might call that your bank account, you might call that your paycheck, whatever it might be, but it can and will determine your usefulness to Him in the here and now. You think about that? The way you conduct your finances? Listen, nobody knows. Your wife or your husband know. Nobody else knows, really, what your income or your outgo other than the IRS. But God knows. Let me ask you this question. The question is not, are you a steward? We've learned this morning that we're all stewards. The question is this, what kind of steward are you? Are you funding His work here and now through regular giving to the local church and through the Faith Promise Missions program that we have here? Are you using your house, your cars, your everything for His glory? Listen, it all belongs to Him and we are but managers. What kind of manager are you? You say, well, God has not given me that much to manage. He's given you enough. He's fulfilled His promise to give you food, clothing, and raiment. I'm not here telling you that being rich is a sin. Having money is sinful. Please don't walk out of here thinking that's what I'm teaching. Not at all. God never chastised Solomon for his wealth. But it was his heart that went astray from God. And my friends this morning, if your heart is wrapped around things, If you have a hunger for bigger and more and better and newer, then you need to repent of that and get it right. Because you cannot be a good and wise steward if you are in love with things. It all belongs to Him. And we are but managers. Listen, if you're immersed in consumer debt, unable to breathe, I'm just going to be honest with you this morning. You're not being a good steward. If you are not living within your means, you are not being a good steward. If you're pursuing things and looking for happiness with more things and stuff, you're not being a good steward. If you have the get more mentality, or if you'd be honest with yourself, and you're not just materialistic, but there's a part of you that is greedy, you just want more, and you want to hoard it. And you think, if I could just have a little more. Because you have that, we have different names for it, American consumerism, materialism, but I'll just tell you what the Bible calls it. It's greed. It's greed. It's not being a good steward. And unfortunately, we've become lukewarm too often in our walk with the Lord because we think we have to fulfill the American dream. And we think we have to live like the Joneses. But I'll tell you something. Your pocketbook will ultimately show God and really, by example, the rest of the world, what you really think is important. Matthew 6:21 says, "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." It is either wicked materialism or wise management. But the principle is still the same. God owns it all, and we are just stewards. A steward is just simply a manager, that which operates or runs something for someone else. What kind of steward are you? Are you a good and wise steward? Are you a steward that is looking out for your best interest instead of God's? I promise you, if you put Him first, He'll work it out. But if you try to finagle it, I'm just telling you. We'll talk about this during giving, but, well, I'll just save it for that. Just ask yourself this morning, what kind of steward are you? Let's pray. Father,